Some would have us believe that if we find parenting difficult, we must not be following the right plan. They might also say that parenting well always results in godly children. If you're like most parents, believing these lies can result in a heavy dose of guilt and shame. Because we live in a broken world as broken parents with broken kids, life is never easy. What we need is a heavy dose of realistic theology and good sense to help us navigate the difficult journey of parenting in ways that help us understand that there is no such thing as a perfect parent. Our friend Leslie Leland Fields has lived this journey. Listen in as she talks to us about her book, Parenting is Your Highest Calling, and 8 Other Myths That Trap Us in Worry and Guilt, along with a whole lot more, on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, it's another week and another Youth Culture Matters podcast. I'm Walt Mueller here at CPYU, along with Jason Sochnick, coming to us live from beautiful downtown Spokane, Washington. Jason, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm surprised you just moved me from North Spokane to downtown Spokane, but it's okay.
Oh, you're in North. I was out there with you
a few weeks ago.
Well,
yeah, you were just here a few weeks ago.
I know. Actually, you know what? I probably would have been accurate on the directions if when I was there and in your car, you weren't driving around like a chicken with your head cut off, trying to get things you had forgotten, or, oh, I missed my turn, or, oh, I missed the exit. I mean, you turned me around and effectively destroyed my internal gyroscope. So I had no idea where I was. I knew I was in Spokane. So I'm assuming you're in downtown.
Yeah, I'm in Spokane. You are right. And yes, I was in North Spokane. And as we record this, I am in North Spokane. But
okay.
Yes.
And that, yeah. So I'm assuming
I did not mean to have your gyroscope misplaced.
Yeah. Actually, I just used that as an excuse. But okay. You were driving around pretty crazy, weren't you, a few times?
One time. You make one time be several times. There was one time I made the wrong turn, and then you turned that into every trip I didn't know where I was going.
It seemed like it was every trip. I don't know. I just was – I don't know what it was, but – So now it makes sense to me. So where I stayed, was that North Spokane?
Yeah, that would have been North Spokane.
Okay,
yep.
which thus is why that one night when I spoke at North Church.
That's exactly right.
All right, okay, I didn't figure out that's now, why they
now,
called it North Church.
I like that you're now piecing it together.
Yeah, it all makes sense.
That's an excellent job, Walt.
It all makes Good sense job. To me, so okay, right. I thought it was named after like Oliver North
but,
or something.
Let's be honest about Spokane. North Spokane, South Spokane, downtown Spokane are all within about a 15 to 20 minute
difference. Right, so you can
this
stand.
This is not like a big city.
You can stand in the middle of Spokane and throw a rock in any direction, and you'll hit all those northeast, west, south. That's just, you're right. It's
yeah,
not
depending
that big,
on how but... you define northeast, west, south. Yeah, that
right.
And you have a really good arm.
Hey, so, I enjoyed my trip there. That was fun. It was fun to be with you. It was fun to speak in those places. You guys did a good job setting things up. So, yeah, it was fun. It was a good time.
Well, you were well loved. It was great to have you out here.
Yeah, well, thanks for inviting me to be out there. So we are going to have a great podcast today. We've got a guest coming in later, Leslie Leland Fields, who's a writer. She's actually a fairly fascinating person, not just in terms of how she shares her experiences in life, and especially with parents. And she's written a lot about being a daughter as well, coming out of her own experiences with her own dad and some other books on that. But she's also written about this aspect of her life, which is really curious, where she lives on an island in Alaska during the summertime and with her family does salmon fishing out of skiffs. So we may get to hear a little bit about that as well. But we do want to talk about youth culture, and I know Kent and Chris want to talk about whatever it is they want to talk about as well.
Sure. We just want to know today, what would your dream car be? What would your dream car be?
Hmm.
And Kenton, I know, but Kenton, he's a motorcycle guy, so maybe it doesn't have to be a car. It could be a vehicle in general. But
oh. So wait, Kenton. Let's start with Kenton. If it's going to be a motorcycle, I got to hear about this. But can I guess before you say what it's going to be?
Yeah.
Is it going to be a Ducati?
No.
It's not.
I'm too tall for a Ducati. Little Italian
okay.
bike.
Yeah.
He's
like the Ferrari of motorcycles.
Right.
And you're more of a cruiser guy, right, or a road bike guy than a, I don't want to say it.
I don't quite know what you mean. I wouldn't say I'm a cruiser guy anymore.
Well, like a more modern
like a cruiser guy. You kind of like James Dean.
for a long time I really wanted one of the fast sport bikes.
Yeah, that's what I meant, sport bikes.
Oh, totally different class than cruiser.
Yeah.
But I used to like those. Now I'm getting a little bit older where even those are going to be a little uncomfortable for longer trips.
Yeah.
So probably dream one would actually probably be the newest model of what I have now. So I'd want to...
What'd you call it? Dream one? What did you just say?
For his dream one.
Oh, his dream one. I thought that was like a making a model. I'm thinking, I haven't heard of that one. What in the world?
I would probably want a 2017 FJR 1300.
Man, I think about those all the time. What
manufacturer for
that
those?
That is a Yamaha.
I'm not familiar with that, actually.
It's probably the fastest bike that you could take for hundreds of miles at a time.
Okay, so it's like a more of a touring bike.
It's a touring bike, but it's super sporty. You could take it to a track any day.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm with you on the sport bikes. I rode one time, and a block was too long. I couldn't stand it. Seriously.
Yep. If you're over 5'10", they're fairly
uncomfortable.
I thought
that the sentence was going to end with, I rode it for one block and then I crashed it.
No, I haven't done that. I've never done that with something with a motor on it that you're on the outside. Come close. When I had my mini bike, I did, back when I was in middle school. I had a little mini bike.
You're riding lawnmower, it doesn't count?
No, and I've never crashed that either. I don't have a riding lawnmower. For that very reason.
That's what I'm for.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you cut the grass.
Oh, yeah.
That's why we have interns here. So, Jason, do you have a car? Go ahead. I got one.
Yeah, when you're growing up, you have your favorites. But as I've gotten older, I don't covet or even desire like a sports car. I like looking at them every so often when they pop up in a movie or I see them on the street. That doesn't happen much in Spokane, but
you don't have to set this up by saying that what you're about to say is not breaking any of the Ten Commandments. We know you don't covet. Just tell us what it is. I mean, if you could wake up and have a dream car, what would it be?
Okay, so the car that I think would be a ton of fun would be the Porsche SUV. The Cayenne.
The Caprice.
Chevrolet participated in its make.
Yeah, thanks for by the way,
that was my first car.
Now that's not surprising. But I want to say, by saying that a Caprice is a Porsche, thanks for taking the mantle of ignorance off of me for a little while.
You're usually the one who's ignorant,
wandering around here not knowing what I'm talking about. So that's good. Yeah.
Well, and then to be more ignorant, there is Porsche and then there's Porsche with the E. So Porsche.
Yeah. Thanks for taking the mantle of ignorance off me again. That was awesome.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
I'm doing you a favor on this podcast.
You are.
I'm just trying to help you. One statement at a time, Walt.
Yeah. Thanks for doing that.
So here, that would probably be, part of it's because it's practical. Part of it is because that engine is stellar, and I just love sitting by cars that then take off and sound like that. I don't know if it's fast. It might be, but it sounds like it's fast. And that'd probably be the closest thing. I just really don't have. I just haven't really kept up with like what are the dream cars, like the Ferraris and the Lamborghinis and those haven't ever really
super
exciting.
I see them and I'm going, why would people want those? You know, take me back to the muscle car era. Those were cars, you know, when you could every year they would change the design by design enough that you could. I mean, it was just cars, the design of cars was an art. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really was. It not to over-spiritualize here, but it was a creative venture, and you would see the image of God in these designers. They were just these beautiful 50s, 60s. I think when you got to about 72, 73, and they came out with those rectangular headlights, everything was ruined. Those weird rectangular headlights.
You know what's interesting, too, about those cars is that the sound of those cars, they actually have sound engineers on the new cars to create the sounds of the old, because the engines today don't sound like the engines of old.
Right.
And so they have to get sound engineers to create a system that allows for the sound to sound like an old muscle car.
Yeah, a deep throaty rumble.
I might actually take mine back only in this sense. My first car I ever owned was a 66 Fastback Mustang. Ooh. I wish I could go back and keep that car and finish it out and have that today. Because that car was awesome. A 289 in it. It had a 2+2, so the back would fold down and then come back up. Before this was even a thing, like in minivans and other places. It was a really fun car. It was I bought it. We got it for I think $1,500, and then we started remodeling it, reworking on it, and then I ended up selling it and getting a newer car. But I really regret getting rid of that car.
I have a few of those that you know that I had that were all used and all very cheap, but I wish we'd never gotten rid of them. Yeah. Hmm. Well, mine. I'll give you. Here's what I'll come up with. I'll state them very quickly. First, I'm going to get one for my wife, because I like her choice as well. And what Lisa would love is an old Toyota Land Cruiser. And we've seen them, you know, like in that tan, khaki color.
Yeah.
Man, when you shine those up with a white top, those things are just awesome. So, you know, if I ever could, I'd get her one of those, you know. Chances of me finding one and being able to pay for it, that's something else.
I'm laughing, Walt, because you said you'd shine it up with a white top. I know what you're talking about.
No, it has a white
top.
But
I had this picture of you
car,
like getting this old Land Cruiser and then you taking a white top and cleaning it off.
No. So. Yeah, sorry about my. Okay, but the mantle of ignorance is back on me now. And then the one I would want would be a, you know, late 60s, maybe 69. Mustang, Carroll Shelby GT, blue with double white stripes down the hood, over the roof, and down over the trunk. I love those cars. And because that was when I was really into cars back then. I was still 4 or 5 years away from driving, but, man, I love those cars. So that. And then can I throw one more in? Would be fun. The family car. So an old, you know, the 60s era, early 60s era, Volkswagen bus with all the windows, you know, and with the front windows that flip up a little bit so you can let the air through the windshield. So, I mean, those are just great. I love watching like the Mecum car auction, and it's just so great to see them bringing those things, as they say, across the block and just look at those cars. I'm always going, hey, Lisa, look at this. Look at this car over here. They're just great. Yeah. So,
gosh, that Volkswagen, that's one of the few cars even today that you could have bought 10 years ago. I mean, the bus today versus what it looked like then and what you're talking about. But it's one of the few cars that appreciates in value. We had friends that bought a VW bus. It was a newer one. It was built in the 90s. But they bought it, I think, for $17,000 or $18,000, turned around and sold it 10 years later after putting probably 100,000 miles on it for $27,000.
Wow.
That's the only vehicle that I know of that you can, beyond some of the muscle cars that we were mentioning, that you can buy and actually not put a whole lot of work into it and sell it for more. It's not, cars aren't like homes. And so it's the same with those buses.
Yeah.
It's really crazy how that works.
Chris, have you jumped up from the Chevy Caprice, or is that the car you want?
Actually, I would. I called it the boat, as you can imagine.
As did everybody else.
I would absolutely love to have that car back.
Yeah.
I would take that car back in a heartbeat.
Do you know, I will go out, and I don't want to drag this on any longer, but I'll just say this. I go out. There is a collector club for every model of car. Because I go out to near us here in Carlisle, they have these big car show events. Kent, you've probably been to them because it's close to your home. So I go out there a couple times a year, and I go to the GM thing. And it's just I go by myself. I walk through. I look at the cars. It's just fun. It's relaxing to me. And there's hundreds of cars there. And they will group them out in the fields by the model. And there's this group of guys that they remodel these, they customize these, the big old Chevy Caprice. And it's really something to see that. I mean, and I'm thinking, like, why are you guys into these things? Because there's really nothing distinctive about them that's beautiful. I mean, the only thing is they're big, and you're going, I mean, the thing that's distinctive about them is you go, why would somebody want those?
That's
what's distinctive about them. So, yeah, oh, that's good. Yeah. So, all right, Kent, you've got your motorcycle. We've got our car. So, hey, let's jump in. That's a good question. By the way, the reason we do this is, of course, we're getting to know each other better here, and we want to get you folks to get to know us. But even more so, these are the kinds of conversations. If you're ever sitting at the table and no one's talking, come up with a crazy question like this. And let's say this. If you have a question you'd like to submit to Chris and Kenton, that you can be asked of us, go ahead and do it at give us the email address.
Send
again.
It to podcast@cpyu.org.
podcast@cpyu.org. We'd love to know what your questions are. All right, let's talk about youth culture, Jason. What's happening? Or culture.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about culture. We love
all right, our good say,
again,
2-minute
good,
drill. Let's
and,
do it.
Yeah, our 2-minute drill. And again, these are the kinds of conversations you can have with kids, youth workers. Talk about the news stories, process them Christianly. Pass these things off to parents. You can be a hero if you make them aware. I'm not sure about some of the stories we have today, but, you know, the kinds of things that we talk about, you need to be having these conversations.
Yeah.
Go, start the timer there.
Yeah. Well, the first story is one that really probably resonates more with those of you that have been in youth ministry a little bit longer or have been in ministry, period, for the last couple of decades. But also as a parent, and that's a story of Richard Simmons. Recently, they had a podcast that was released on Where is Richard Simmons? And it was number one on the iTunes podcast list, and I took a listen to it. It was fascinating. I don't know if you've listened to this, Walt, but
I haven't.
6 episodes, but you know who Richard Simmons is correct?
Yeah,
very lively, energetic, famous for sweating to the oldies, the wheel deal meal thing that made him millions of dollars.
Forgot
and he
about
was in
that.
The limelight for many a year. And he recently, back in 2014, stepped out of the limelight, stepped out of some of the fame and fortune that had been coming his way for several decades. And many people started to be concerned. What happened? What went on? And this podcast explores both the backstory, some of the theatrics, and some of the things that potentially could have happened, and really kind of ends on this down note, having said Richard Simmons really probably was just tired and stepped out of the fame and fortune cycle that he had been caught up in. And it was really, really fascinating to hear what other people were saying, what others were thinking, and I think it relates directly to what we do. Here's what it says, in this article that I found specifically talking about this podcast, but as unsatisfying as the show was a mystery, it was fascinating as a study of what we ask of public figures, of what we feel entitled to ask of them. And one of the things that we often do is I think those of us that are in ministry have to recognize, although we might not be known by a lot of people, we are intimately known by a small group of people. And I think fame, we've talked about this, is quickly starting to change. It's no longer being known for your 15 minutes, but it's being known within a small group. And so I think we have to be really careful with what we do with that small group. The scope of where we are known and seen, we have to recognize our limits and what we give and how we give and to the extent that we give. So laying out clear boundaries, knowing how you're going to step into some of these different aspects of life, quote-unquote fame, within the scope that you've been given is really important. Drawing clear boundaries, I think, is a very healthy thing. And if you ever take a listen to this podcast or even just listen to some of the article, or I'm sorry, read some of the articles on this, you're going to find that there just weren't a lot of boundaries for him. And so he really had no other choice but to quickly step out. And we see this a lot in ministry, people burning out and needing to step away. And so boundaries, I think, help a lot with that.
I'm just going to add an aside to that. As you talk about fame and you talk about ministry, when you're in ministry, don't seek fame. I love what our friend Rich Van Pelt says about some great advice that was given to him early on. You take care of the depth of your ministry and let God take care of the breadth. All right, quickly here, because you took up about a minute and a half of my time. Did you pick up on that? You went over after the bell. All right, so, hey, I want to talk about summer's coming. We're going to be out in the sunshine. Our kids are going to be out there. We live in a culture that's all about appearance. Certainly tanning has been a big part of our world, and, you know, we assume we got to get out in the sun and get tan. There's some new research coming out from the CDC right now that says that the number of U.S. teenagers who are using indoor tanning has dropped by half in recent years. That's great news. Only about 7% of high school students said they used indoor tanning in 2015. That was down from almost 16% of students in 2009. What that means, however, is there's still over a million kids who are putting themselves at increased risk of skin cancer, including the most severe form of skin cancer, which is melanoma, by going to a tanning salon. And they've also found, this is another interesting statistic, that among the 1.2 million high school students who are continuing to indoor tan, 82% of them experienced a sunburn in the last year, which means that the danger for melanoma, the risk factor, has increased nearly doubling, more than twofold over the lifetime for a risk of melanoma. Look, all that to say, we go back to this again and again. You know, standards of beauty, when we strive for those and trying to fit in and look good and curate ourselves, there can be some dangers from time to time, not just spiritual dangers, but in this case, physical dangers. And so we need to worship the Lord with good stewardship of our body. Hey, look at that.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Somehow I feel like I was cut short, but.
Well,
no.
You weren't cut short. You just have something.
Okay. All right.
You have aspire to now.
Okay. Well, we'll aspire to it in this very moment right now. Well, here we go. So here's something that happens often when we're speaking at youth groups. This happened after the conference that we just hosted that you were a part of, Walt, and that's conversations around sexual abuse, those that are coming forward, both speaking about it and parents asking how do we prevent it. And I think that that's an important thing to consider. And what research and what therapists and what even those that have spoken on this quite a bit, and this is what I also share, is that in order to help children understand and prevent sexual abuse, you got to talk about sex and sexuality early and often. The Indianapolis Star actually reported just recently that there were 360 cases in which gymnasts accused coaches of sexual transgressions over 20 years. This has been in the news, has been talking about, and I bring that up as a point for us to look at the need to be able to have these conversations. I think that sometimes we avoid certain conversations in the hopes that they just won't ever come up, but we have to be able to recognize that some of the best ways that we can prevent sexual abuse is by talking about it. And here are some just really quick things to be aware of. First of all, and this is something we always say, use correct terms for body parts, penis, vagina. It's not a woo-woo and a wee-wee. Be very clear about it. Talk to your child about touch, good touch, bad touch. These are really important things for us to have conversations about. But I also think that we got to go further than that. And we've got to explain to our sons and our daughters that there are individuals that may trick or bribe them to go beyond the boundaries that we have talked about as parents with our son or daughter. And this might not be happening when they're two or three, but it might be happening as they get a little bit older, when they are walking to the bus stop on their own, when they're spending any sort of time outside by themselves. And then the other thing, and this is something that should be a given, but it's not always, is that we have to recognize we need to have sex talks. It's not one big talk. It's an ongoing conversation. It starts when they're young and moves on until when they're older.
You're trying to sneak that in there at the end, and it just that bell just messed you up, didn't it?
I don't know why I'm talking about this today, but yeah. I feel okay.
All right, okay.
I feel okay.
All right.
Got it in.
Okay. Hey, the Monitoring the Future survey. I don't know. I've talked about this for years in books I've written. I write about this. It's the most reliable long-term study of kids and drug use and attitudes about drug use and certain drugs. It's all broken down to different drugs. This comes from the Institute for Social Research. It's called Monitoring the Future. Every December since 1975, the statistics are released for drug use trends and attitudes among 8th, 10th, and 12th graders. Fascinating stuff. Well, this last year when the data was released, they said that overall drug use is trending down. That's great news. Marijuana use, of course, is up, but overall drug use is down. And we could talk about opioids and things like that. But the questions being asked, why is it trending down? You know, is this the result of our educational efforts? Is it the result of better parenting? Is it the result of all the, you know, ads that come out from the ad council that we see on television, here on the radio? It could be some of that, and hopefully it is, but there is a lot of speculation right now that is generating some research work that's saying that maybe what our kids are doing is trading one drug for another. And we're talking about illicit drugs as the drug they're trading away, and what they're trading for or trading up to or over to would be their smartphones and technology. So some of the research that's being done is saying that kids are now spending more time with their phones and consequently less time with technology. And there's even some speculation. David Greenfield, the assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine, and he's also the founder of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction, says this: people are carrying around a portable dopamine pump, and kids have basically been carrying it around for the last 10 years. He's talking about smartphone technology. All we're doing is saying, be aware of this and monitor how much your kids are using this. Too much is not a good thing. Could be addictive.
I like how you slipped that in right at the very
end.
Good
did.
Job, Walt. Well, last that I'll share is just the ongoing name brand recognition of Converse. Converse recently released a film, and I would actually suggest watching it and maybe even consider sharing it with your youth to have conversations around image and style and the influence that it has on the way that we live and think. But Converse did this short film. They included a lot of popular individuals among youth. One was an NBA player, Jordan Clarkson. Another was a rapper, Vince Staples, Vince Staples, who was a part of a group. Actress Millie Bobby Brown, who, if you haven't already watched Stranger Things, was 11 in Stranger Things. There was a model, Winnie Harlow, who is actually famous for some of her skin pigmentation, but has become a famous model because of that. Actress Macy Williams, who is in Game of Thrones. And just by mentioning some of these shows and some of these names, what you recognize is some of the celebrity power that's behind them. But when you watch the film, it's really about you being you.
Hey, give us the name of the film and what it's about.
It's called Forever Chuck, and it's about really style, the ongoing legend of Converse, but how Converse defines who you are. So it's curating your name, your brand, based upon you wearing Converse.
Yeah.
Chuck
Taylor All-Star.
Chuck Taylor.
Specifically,
yep,
yeah.
Exactly. And so the thing I was just going to recommend is using the 3 Ds that you have developed here at CPYU. To be able to pursue conversation around this, discover, discern, decide, use those to be able to have conversations in your small groups, in your youth groups, to be able to spur on and discuss ways in which individual commercials like this can impact the way that we think, the way that we buy, and ultimately the way that we respond.
Hmm. Hey, good. You nailed it there. Look, hey, all right, let me give you one last trend here. And this one I think is really important because it's a healthcare concern, and I'm going to bypass. I know I told you I was going to talk about girls and sports and concussions, but I want to move on to something else here. We'll hit that the next time. But a story that comes from USA Today, and the headline is this: your iPhone's dirtier than a toilet, and so are these other everyday items. And so, it was really interesting. You know, when you touch your iPhone to your face, the story asks, are you touching fecal matter right now? And so researchers at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine found fecal matter on 1 out of every 6 of the phones that they surveyed. That was in 2011. and a biologist, microbiologist at the University of Arizona, has found that cell phones carry 10 times the bacteria of most toilet seats. And they've warned as well about other items that we need to be careful about: shoes, the kitchen sink, playground equipment where we take our kids. And this one was surprising. Reusable shopping bags carry a lot of bacteria. So, yeah, check this one out. It's called, you will include a link to it, Your iPhone's Dirtier Than a Toilet. And let me just say, this is another reason why I have an Android.
Amen.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I like that you had to end with that.
Yeah. Well, they didn't say Android's dirtier than a toilet.
iPhone is synonymous with all phones. They don't even say smartphones anymore. They say iPhones.
Oh, really?
Your Android fits under the category of
iPhone. Says the fanboy.
So you're saying this is fake news, what I just read? Is that what you're saying?
I'm just reading what
it says there. It says your iPhone's dirtier than a toilet. That's why I have an Android. All right?
Oh.
See?
Well,
I'm winning.
Argument now? You enjoy your Android. I enjoy my iPhone.
Yeah.
And together we will. Our maybe just the iPhone users will enjoy the fecal matter that now exists on our phones.
Yeah.
It's just
an extra feature. I was flipping through on my Dell laptop in a presentation last week. I was flipping through some slides very quickly, and everything went white. So, you know, when it all went white, what I did was I just had to say, hey, I'm hung up here. And, of course, someone goes, you got a problem. You need a Mac. So, hey, we're going to come back. Stick with us. We're going to come back, and we are going to talk to Leslie Leyland Fields. We'll introduce her in just a bit. Stick with us, and we'll be back after this break. In an effort to help you help the kids you know and love navigate their emerging sexuality to the glory of God, we've launched a sexual integrity initiative here at CPYU. Thanks to a generous grant from a company called DAS, you can access our sexual integrity initiative and a growing number of resources for free by visiting the website at sexualintegrityinitiative.com. Well, welcome back, everybody, to this episode of Youth Culture Matters. Jason, I am pretty excited about the conversation we're going to have now because we're going to talk to someone who actually is not just a writer, but who has written some wonderful, wonderful words for parents that I first encountered back in January of 2010 in an article in Christianity Today called, the article was titled, The Myth of the Perfect Parent. Absolutely liberating. I started to hand it on to the parents that I was able to speak to, and many of them found it incredibly liberating as well. And I took the opportunity then to, I think, email Leslie Leyland Fields, who wrote the article. One thing led to another. She said, hey, this is actually part of a book that I've written called Parenting is Your Highest Calling and 8 Other Myths That Trap Us in Worry and Guilt. That is actually, one of 11 books you've written, Leslie? You've written 11?
Yeah. Well, technically 10, but I just signed my contract for my 11th book.
Okay.
So,
all right. Well, we'll count that as 11. That's great.
Yeah.
And so I got this book. I read it. Lisa read it. We found it incredibly liberating from start to finish. Just a wonderful biblical approach to parenting. We started to pass it on to parents everywhere we had the chance to speak. And I know the article's been out for years. We're going, why are we talking about it now? It's still so relevant. So, Leslie Leyland Fields, welcome. And you are in Alaska.
Yep.
Right now.
Yep. I'm in Kodiak. I'm in my office, which is right over the Pacific Ocean, right over the Gulf of Alaska.
Okay. Now, when people think about living in Alaska, what kind of stereotypes? Because we're here in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. They think we have horses and buggies, so
I'm in the Northwest, and everyone thinks we hug trees.
Well,
so.
that's actually true.
But you do.
That is true. Yeah, and you dress your dogs.
I do too, so.
Yeah, let's gang up on him.
Dress
I
our
like
dogs.
This already.
Yeah.
This is good. But I'm looking, and you know, I'm like, so what are some of the stereotypes? Because I see a wall behind you. It's not made of snow. Which is pretty amazing.
No, it's not.
An igloo.
You know what? wouldn't you think that by now, all those, you know, the stereotypes that kids, you know, learn in second or third grade about Eskimos living in igloos and everybody, you know, taking their dog sled to school. Well, I still get that. And also that Alaska is always cold everywhere, and that it's always dark all the time. So those are some of the stereotypes.
Wait, that isn't true?
No, it's not true.
Okay.
Well, this will make for some good questions later, Jason, I'm sure.
Let's just say that Leslie might be the first person that we've ever had on the podcast that is sitting right directly above the Pacific Ocean, or right next to the Pacific Ocean. We've not had anyone on the podcast that has been able to look out their window and say, there is the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
So that's pretty nice.
Now, I'm proud of that.
Now, I know a little bit of your story because I've read, you know, some of the other books, and we may be able to talk about some of those. You've actually written books about this vocation that your family is involved in, which is absolutely fascinating. I read, what was the one? You sent me one. Now I'm drawing a blank here. I'll get it here. Surviving the Island of Grace.
Right.
That's it. It's over at home on my shelf over there. Just a fascinating book. Talk about what you and your family do, because this we'll never have anybody on here who does this.
Yeah. So, and I just want to update that a little bit. My new book, Crossing the Waters, is kind of a bit of a sequel to Surviving the Island of Grace. So, my family and I have six children, and my husband and I. We live in Alaska. We live on Kodiak Island. But in the summer, we leave the big city of Kodiak, which is about 13,000 people, and we fly to the other side of Kodiak Island, to a little island off of Kodiak Island where just my family and I live. So there are just 10 of us, about 10 of us on that island, and we commercial fish for salmon off that island. So we're there from May, the end of May, to about mid-September, and we live there. We are out on the water most of the time, and we're mending net. We're catching fish. We're using an outhouse.
Yeah.
So it's beautiful. The buildings are beautiful, but it's still, I suppose, some people would call it primitive.
Now, you do this fishing. I mean, a lot of times we watch these shows on TV and we see these big boats. That's not what you're in. You're in these skiffs.
Right, right, right. Yeah, so we tend to think of fishing as just sort of these larger boats, like in Deadliest Catch. Those are huge boats that go out in the Bering Sea to catch crab. And so we're in smaller boats, like 26 to 28-foot boats, and we're going out to nets that are actually attached to shore. So our kind of fishing is called set netting. So we're set netters for salmon. There are lots of different gear types for catching fish and catching salmon.
So just for someone who has no clue what this involves other than reading about it and hearing you talk about it, on a given day, a good day, above average day, what do you measure the fish in pounds? How many pounds of fish will you catch in a day?
Exactly. Yeah, it's in pounds. So, the last two seasons have been really, really poor. So we would have been happy to catch, you know, 5 to 10,000 pounds of fish, which isn't very much. And on a good day, you know, more than that, a lot more than that is what we hope for. But we've had some really poor seasons the last few years.
Oh man. And I've read a little bit about there's a book I read called Fish. I don't know if you've read that, or Five Fish, I think it's called, about salmon fishing. And are you having to struggle with a lot of the regulations that the government's imposing on this now? Or I'm just asking about fishing first, because I find this fascinating.
There are a lot of regulations, and we are grateful for the regulations. Fish and Game has done a marvelous job of protecting and kind of nurturing the salmon stocks. The salmon fishery in Alaska is very healthy very strong, very healthy. And that's because it's managed so well. The fact that we've had a couple of bad years speaks to some other issues, and it may very well be linked to global warming. Our waters are 5 degrees warmer than they were even just 10 years ago. So we think that's having an impact on the salmon. And this is being studied really closely. We don't have a conclusion about it yet, but we're all really concerned about it.
Wow. I just find the whole fishing thing is, you know, it's so out of the box for me that it's kind of neat to see that. I would highly recommend that book, Surviving the Island of Grace, which tells some great stories and really gives you a sense of what that's all about. So you do this with your family, your kids are involved, and I'm sure this has made you, when you get to work with your kids, you get to think a lot about being a mom, being a dad. And this article, I want to shift over to that, The Myth of the Perfect Parent, subtitled Why the Best Parenting Techniques Don't Produce Christian Children. Where did this article come from? There's passion in it, which I love, so...
Okay, I have to, let me tell you where the book came from, because the article came from the book.
Okay.
And the book came from this particular day when I loaded, my husband travels a lot. He's gone a lot. So I'm home in Kodiak with 6 children, a girl and 5 boys. And I want the audience to, I don't know, give me a little moan of sympathy for having for 5 boys, because it's 5 boys in a row. It's just this gang of boys. And so it was this one winter day. Of course, it's been, you know, dark for weeks, and everybody's cranky and fighting, and I'm trying to get the, you know, the baby fed and everybody out the door. And by the time we get in the car, you know, this is a familiar scenario. By the time we get in the car, everybody's fighting and squabbling and mad. And I am too. And we get to school. And of course my kids go to a Christian school, and I like kick them out of the car, you know, to the Christian school, like, God bless your day, and, you know, get out of my sight, sort of this, you know. We were just so angry with each other because my kids were not obeying. And I just drove, after I kicked my kids out of the car, got everybody to where they needed to be, I drove to this park that's over the ocean near my house. And I got out of the car and I ran into the woods, and I just was sobbing and crying out to God, God, where are you in this whole parenting thing? You know, where is this happy, peaceful Christian home, you know, that I expected, that Christian radio led me to expect, that every Christian book I picked up, you know, there's just sort of this idea that if you're doing it right, everyone's going to be happy and obedient, and life at home is just going to be wonderful. And that was not what was going on in my home. And I felt betrayed. And so I'm calling out to God. And I said, I said, God, what do you know about parenting anyway? And the minute I said that, I just stopped. And it suddenly occurred to me that the Old Testament, I was reading through the Old Testament that year, and it suddenly occurred to me that the Old Testament is a record of God's life as a parent, and that God knew exactly how I was feeling. Because when we read through the Old Testament, I mean, Israel, he calls Israel my firstborn son, right? Israel is his son. And what was that parenting experience like for God the Father? It was horrible. It was a lot like my experience. It was full of frustration, full of, you know, God says, I have poured myself out to you. I've held my arms out to you all day long, and you will not come. And And I recognized immediately that, wait a minute, God's parenting life looks an awful lot like my parenting life. And wait a minute, God's parenting life does not look like what I'm hearing on Christian radio and what I'm hearing from Christian books. And I realize that we have created some sort of alternate reality about Christian parenting. And that if we really want to look at Christian parenting biblically, we're going to have to go back to the scriptures again and look at them from Genesis to Revelation and take off this really tiny lens that we had created. You know, we mostly have been looking at parenting through the lens of a couple of verses, and one verse in particular, which most people, you know, your parent, you can recite it by heart, Proverbs 22:6, right? Train up a child. Should we say it together,
yeah.
Walt?
Train
up a child in the way he should go.
And when he is old,
he will not depart from it. Yeah. Yeah. So we have taken that verse and we have turned it into some sort of magic formula, some sort of promise. And it's not a promise. But there's a lot more to get into there. But that's how the book started, when I realized I was trying to do all the things the Christian parenting books were telling me to do, and it wasn't working. This happy, peaceful home, these perfect, wonderful, obedient children. Nope, was not happening. And I realized the whole premise of Christian parenting, we were building, we were creating a building on the wrong foundation.
Hmm. Now, Jason's kids are young. How old are your kids, Jason?
They're 3, 1.5, and then we've got another on the way.
Right. Real soon.
Four. Yes.
Mine are all adults. Leslie, how old are your kids?
They're 28 down to 14.
Okay. All right. So just a little bit younger than mine. I wish I'd heard this when my kids were little, because it's so liberating. So you walked away from that.
Yeah.
And now what's happening? I mean, you run into the woods. When you come out of the woods, what's changed?
What's changed is I feel this huge sense of relief. Number one, God understands what it's like to parent children who are imperfect and disobedient, and who are human beings in formation. God understands, and he not only understands, I look at how many times his heart was broken by his own children. And then I know, okay, God gets it. God is with me in this. And I vowed right then and there, I'm going to go back through the scriptures very carefully, and I want to have a larger, deeper understanding of what this whole enterprise is about, this whole business of raising kids. Is it really to create, you know, is it really our job to create perfect followers of Christ? And how can that be possible? How can I control who my children become if I can't even control myself?
Jason, one of the things that, yeah, go ahead.
Well, yeah, one of the things that you mentioned in the article, I'm assuming it's a big part of your book, is separating the difference between parenting successfully and parenting faithfully, which I thought was a great distinction. Can you describe each? Because even as a parent, as a new parent, I thought, gosh, what a great word.
One of the myths in my parenting book is that successful parenting will produce godly children. And so, and you know what? That is probably the most prevalent myth that most people still believe. And the idea is that we can measure at the end of the day, literally at the end of the 24-hour day, and at the end of the day when our children grow up and move away and are adults, that we can base how effective and how good and how godly and how biblical our parenting is based on how our kids turn out. So, right, we want that formula. We want that equation. If I do A, B, C, D, my child will be E, F, G, H. You know, my biblical parenting will produce a kid who loves God and gives his life to Christ and, you know, and serves God all his days. But the problem is that all along the way, day by day, our kids aren't exactly who we want them to be, right? Even a three-year-old. I remember my daughter when she was two, she was so defiant. She would just raise her fist in my face and say, you know, no, I'm not going to do it. You know, she was so defiant. And I would feel like a horrible parent. Like, I can't control this two-year-old. And then when my kids became teenagers, this isn't working. I'm doing this biblical parenting thing. I raised them in the church, took them to youth group, read them Bible stories. We pray every night. I'm doing all this stuff. What's wrong with the formula? And what happens is, here's what happens. We think, okay, my kid is not turning out the way I am hoping and praying, so I must be doing something wrong. It's my fault. And then we think, okay, more Bible, more prayer, more church, more Sunday school. So we try to do more and more of the same things because we think the fault is ours. And that's what happens. This is incredible load of guilt because we think we are supposed to produce these godly children. And what's so freeing and liberating is that I am not God. I am not sovereign over my children. Only God is sovereign. And I have to step out of that position of thinking and believing that I am God and that I can shape and mold and train and create this perfect follower of Christ. I can't do that. That's God's job.
This is really good. I love what you're saying here, and we're going to take a little break. When I come back, I want us to talk about what this approach to parenting that the Christian books and Christian radio have promoted for so long, what this actually does to our kids, because it's not healthy for them. It's not good for them, and I know you've thought about that. So we'll come back. When we come back, we'll talk about that. We're talking to Leslie Leyland Fields. It's about an article she wrote several years ago called The Myth of the Perfect Parent, which actually comes out of a book called Parenting is Your Highest Calling, and 8 other myths that trap us in worry and guilt. Whenever I mention that from the front when I'm talking to a group, they giggle a little bit about the title because it's not what you'd expect for a Christian book, and that's exactly what we need, Christian parenting book. It takes this kind of approach. So stick with us, and we'll be back right after this break. Here at CPYU, we're taking steps to help parents, youth workers, educators, and anyone else who cares about kids help the kids they know and love navigate the difficult issues of life. We've put together a one-day training seminar called Tackling the Tough Stuff that we can bring to your community. Over the course of the day, Marv Penner and I will provide information and practical steps you can take to address narcissism, pornography, self-injury, depression, suicide, and a variety of other tough issues kids face in today's world. To learn more about bringing Tackling the Tough Stuff to your church or community, go to cpyu.org/toughstuff or call us at 1-800-807-CPYU. Welcome back, everybody, to Youth Culture Matters and a great conversation we're having with Leslie Leyland Fields. Leslie is a writer. And she's got a family that fishes as well, which is fascinating. We're talking about The Myth of the Perfect Parent, an article that Leslie wrote several years ago that's part of her book, Parenting is Your Highest Calling, and 8 Other Myths That Trap Us in Worry and Guilt. Now, I hope you're a good sport, Leslie, because we do this thing called Take 5 when we come back from this break, and it's in Jason's hands today. So he's going to fire at you, if you're open to this, 5 questions, just whatever comes off the top of your head, the answer. This is a great way for us to get to know you and for folks who are listening to get to know you. I think already they know you're human, because they heard that you went into the woods and screamed at God.
Yes.
So, but this is another great way to affirm your humanness. So, Jason, go ahead. See, I asked her if she would give permission, but I didn't give her an opportunity to answer. So we're just assuming she's going to play we're along hoping. Here.
All right. Shoot. Ready.
All right. Good.
Okay. So softball question, which sometimes means difficult. But no, this will be softball. Are you usually late, early, or right on time?
It depends how many kids are with me.
if you're by yourself.
Early.
Okay.
Early.
If you're
always
with kids.
Early. On time.
Really? Even to church?
Yes. Yep.
Wow, good for you.
Yep.
That's
I'm just I'm that,
that is
one.
Impressive.
I'm that one like out
that
the
is.
Door, out the door, out the door. That's me.
Okay, excellent. Okay. Tell us about your favorite childhood book.
My favorite childhood book was this collection of Mother Goose rhymes that I got when I was 5, and it was about 300 pages, and I promptly memorized most of the rhymes in that book, and I think that's why I became a writer. It's because of
really?
Mother Goose.
That's great. So do you remember any one of those rhymes that you can repeat right now?
Peter, pumpkin eater, had a wife and couldn't feed her. Kept her in a pumpkin shell, and there he fed her very well. And let's not talk about the political and social ramifications of that.
Very
incorrect.
Yeah.
Very politically incorrect.
Okay. All right. We'll move on then. Number 3, which TV family, because I'm fascinated by your family and what you do and where you live. I love it. Which TV family do you think is most like your own?
I don't have TV. We don't have TV.
No.
Oh, man.
So that's how I'm going to get out of that one. We've never had TV in our home. So.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Let's do this. I was thinking, are there any books that would have families in them or families that you've read about? I don't even know if that will work. Okay.
No, well, let me. The answer is no. No, I've not seen my family in any books because we are, you know, we live in Alaska and we live out in the wilderness for part of the year and my kids grow up in the skiff and everyone works really hard and I've got 5 boys and so I don't see any family. Okay.
Okay. Let me rephrase it then. If you were to title a book that was specifically about your family and you were to give it a name, what would it be called?
Holy Chaos, I guess.
Ah, that's good.
Holy
that's
Chaos.
Great. I love it. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's excellent. Well, let me ask this then. Tell us about someone you admire and why.
Okay, I'm going to get a little bit political. I admire President Obama because when the transition, I don't know when I've seen a more beautiful example of grace and graciousness when he turned the White House and everything over to President Trump. And there was a lot of turmoil and there was a lot of just, you know, a lot of just unsettledness and yet President Obama and his wife were incredibly and beautifully and I think biblically gracious in how they managed that whole transition.
Wow, that's great. And then last question. What do you think is the I don't even know. I feel weird asking this question after such a great response in the last one. So I probably should have asked this question before that. So we'll just see how this goes. But what is your favorite smell in the whole world?
This question comes up quite a bit. So this is
it's
not
it
unique
is.
To
Something
you.
We've we had... ask on our
yeah.
podcast.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to tell you, it's not perfume because my husband always wants me to wear perfume and I hate wearing perfume. So it's not perfume. I would say it's lilacs, fresh lilacs. I like to smell them outside, and I like to smell them in flowers on my table. But I'm not going to wear lilac perfume. That's
all right.
My answer.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you so much for participating in our Take Five. That was excellent.
I'm surprised you didn't say fish or something like that.
My favorite smell?
Well, I don't know. I can only imagine fish, you know, just thinking about fish and all the smells of fish. So we have Amish farmers around here. You know, they spend a lot of time on the farm, and they tend to absorb into their clothes whatever it is that they're farming or working with. And I wondered if the same thing happened with fishermen people.
Well, it absolutely does. Yeah. That everyone comes in, all their fishing clothes go up against the stove. And so the whole house is filled with baked fish curry smell. Okay. So, but that is not my favorite smell.
Yeah. Did you get to, all right, let me ask you this. Have you gotten to a point where you really don't smell it anymore?
Yeah.
Okay. Because they tell us when we live here, there's certain things like Jason will come to visit. He'll go, oh, it smells like Lancaster County. And I'm going, really? I don't really smell it anymore. So, okay. Yeah, we get used to it. We adapt. Mm-hmm. All right. Good. Thanks for being a good sport there and working your way through Jason's silliness. Hey, let's shift gears. During the break, we were talking about parenting and some of the specifics of parenting. And you mentioned something, you talked a little bit about, you know, when we have a tough kid, a kid who's especially difficult for us. Share some of that. That was really good.
Yeah. One of my sons, all through really junior high and high school, just was, became really sort of hostile toward me, and he wouldn't speak, and there was very little eye contact, and I just did not know what was going on. And I tried repeatedly, you know, to connect with him, to find out what was happening, and there he just completely shut down toward me. And I really got the very strong sense that he actually even hated me, and I do mean that word. And so I had such a hard time, and because the biblical mandate, you know, is to love our children, love, we're supposed to even love our enemies, right? So we're supposed to love our enemies. I better be loving my son here, even though he seems to be hating me. So I had to really work through that, because when we think of love, we often think of it in terms of reciprocity. You know, I love you, you love me back. That's sort of how we think of love. And we also think of love as an emotion. So here I was not having loving thoughts and loving feelings toward my son. And I was violating what I thought was a core principle of parenting. And that is that you will always feel unconditional love for your child. But I began to recognize that that's a myth. We don't always feel unconditional love for our child, and begin to really think about what love is, and begin to realize that love is not primarily an emotion. You know, love is action. Love is a decision. And what matters most is not do I feel loving toward my child, but am I being loving toward my child? And I had to check myself constantly. Am I being loving toward this son who is just, you know, giving me hostility? But there's a happy end to the story. Just a few months ago, this son is all grown up now and off on his own. And we were together for the weekend. And I asked him, I said, hey, What was going on back in high school? I felt like you hated me. And he said, yeah, I did hate you. And I felt really glad, you know, sort of affirmed by that. Okay, I wasn't reading the signals wrong. He really did hate me. And then I said, well, why did you hate me? What was going on? And he said, honestly, I don't even know. I don't even know. And, you know, we ended that conversation with him telling me that he loved me, and me telling him how much I loved him. And, you know, we got through that time. And I'm going to tell you, it was honestly about 10 years. And it's really hard to feel like your kid hates you for 10 years. but it was God's example of constant love. And again, love not as a feeling, but God's faithfulness to continue loving and nurturing, you know, his children, that kept me going.
That is a great word. And I think not just for moms and dads, but for spouses, because the way that love has been misshapen and ill-defined by our culture, it's this, you know, this feeling. And so we constantly think love just ends, love left the room.
Right.
And it's a commitment. So that is it. That's a good word. Let me go back to what you talk about in the myth of the perfect parent and this assumption that we have. Somehow we've grown up with it. Christian books, Christian radio propagate this, that perfect parents, good parents, raise good kids, raise perfect kids. What does that kind of pressure put on? What does that do to our kids? What kind of pressure does that put on our kids, those kinds of expectations?
That's such a great question, Walt, because we know what it does to us. We know that it just, you know, creates this impossible burden that nobody is able to carry. But it does the same thing to our kids. It puts this huge burden on our kids. You know, another myth is that good parenting leads to happy children. You know, so we expect that if we're parenting biblically and we're parenting well, our children will not only be successful, they will be godly and they will be happy. And we end up trying to get all our fulfillment through our kids as well. And we're putting this whole burden on them. They have to fulfill us. They have to make us happy. They have to make us feel successful as parents. And our children were not intended to carry that burden. So it's a weight that they cannot carry either.
Yeah. One of the things that we're real concerned about here is how this contributes to not just the pressures that our kids feel, but shame. And I've heard shame described, you know, like guilt is about what you've done. Shame is about who you are. And I wonder if a lot of this myth of the perfect parent has been propagated by and advanced by a church culture that is all about shame. So we're concerned about how we look to our other peers in the pews or the chairs. Do you run into that a lot as you talk to people in your conversations? I'm sure that when you go to speak about these things, that just pops the lid off the barrel and people come out and talk about this. Is this something that you hear about a lot? Does that make sense, that question? Or
I don't hear people talking about shame a lot. I think guilt is the word that is still used most frequently. And when I travel around the country and speak to parents, I do this little exercise. I ask them, okay, take out a piece of paper. Now, I want you to, we're just going to take 5 minutes, jot down the things that you feel guilty about as a parent. And I give them 5 minutes and they, oh man, are they writing, like, you know, they look like they're writing a book. And I say, okay, stop. That's enough. That's enough guilt. Now turn that sheet over on the other side. Now I want you to write down the things that you feel good about as a parent. What are some of the things that you know you're doing well, you feel good about? And they'll sit there and they'll finally manage to get down, you know, to, or three things. You know, I give my kids peanut butter and jelly sandwiches on whole wheat bread every day. And then I tell them, look at that guilt list. And then look at that good list. What's going on here? There's something, and it becomes immediately this visible manifestation of, we've got a problem. We've got a huge problem with guilt and expectations.
Mm-hmm. Wow. What would you say? There was recently a study that had looked at the impact that parenting had, and parents that were older, that had kids that were older, and the loss of sleep, that there's a growing epidemic of parents that are losing sleep over the grown children because of how they might have parented when they were younger. And I'm just curious what you would say to that parent that might be listening that has older children and sometimes sits in the guilt of what they did, or also then sit in the worry of what their child is doing now. So how would you speak to that parent that has older children?
Jason, I'm sorry, ask that question again.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the things that we've just recently read was there was an article that looked at a growing trend among parents that are losing sleep over either mistakes that they feel like they made when they were younger with their children, and then also a growing epidemic of parents that are losing sleep over what their children are now doing as they're older, and the failure guilt that they've had in the midst of all that. How would you speak to that parent that has older children in the midst of all the things that they might be thinking about?
You know, it's never too late to start parenting differently. And when you've got teenagers and maybe you look back and you think, wow, I don't like the way I was so rigid or so formulaic, or I don't like the way I was too permissive, or whatever. If you're a thinking parent, we all do this. We all look back and recognize that we made some mistakes along the way. And you know what? Our kids know that too. Our kids know when we've made errors in judgment, or when we were too harsh, or when we were not, you know, didn't discipline them maybe as much as we needed to. And it's never too late to take stock of where you are now in your relationship with your kids and to do something new and do something better. So my four older children are grown and gone, and I have two teenagers left. And one of the things that I've seen is that I've learned from my four older kids is to stay in close relationship with my teenagers as much as possible. It's easy to check out. It's easy to check out because the teens can check out of a relationship with you. They want to go off and do their own thing. They want to be independent. And so I've learned from parenting my older kids that I want to do this a little differently. I want to be more intentional about cultivating relationship with my teenagers, even as they're pulling away. I'm gonna love them a little more intentionally, and we're gonna work a little harder at finding some activities that we can do together. So you can shoot yourself with guilt over what you did before, but don't do that. That's wasted energy. Look ahead and look to the moment now. What can I do? What can I do now to strengthen my love relationship with my child right now, and begin today, begin now. And relationships are so flexible and so pliable. And even if you've had a rotten relationship with your kid in the past, you can start having a great relationship with him or her starting today, starting right now. That's what's so wonderful about it.
This is good. I want to ask you one last question, and this will be helpful to me. I think it'll be helpful to all the parents who are listening. And as I'm envisioning you on that day you described at the beginning of the podcast where you dropped your kids off or kicked them out of the car, you know, at school, then you went off by yourself and you screamed at God and you came back out and had this epiphany and this transformation. I'm thinking about one of our friends we've had on the podcast, Scotty Smith. I don't know if you've ever seen Scotty's books, Everyday Prayers, and Scotty's involved with the Gospel Coalition. And he talks a lot in his prayers about preaching the gospel to yourself. And as I've read the article, as I've listened to you talk, as I've read other things you've written, it seems that you do that a lot. I mean, that's a great, great habit. What particular aspects of the gospel do you find that it's important for parents to be focusing on and preaching to themselves to help them as they parent? Is that a fair question?
Yeah. I think the most important thing is that we start off on our knees. We start off before God, just humble and empty and broken. And this is what, this is one of the great things about parenting, right? Because that's what parenting does. It humbles us, it empties us, it breaks us, and it helps us recognize, wow, I am not the powerful, sovereign person that I thought I was. And I love this, that that children really reduce us to what we truly are, and that is a beggar before the throne of God. And I think we have to keep focused on who God is, on his attributes, on his majesty, on his purposes in this world. And we want to align ourselves as parents with his purposes. And I think when we're filled up with God himself, then we have something to give to our children. That's what we have to give to our children. When we, and one of the reasons that I wrote this last book, Crossing the Waters, that book is a trip through the Gospels, through through the four Gospels. I spend a lot of time very carefully following after Jesus. If we want our kids to be Christians, and what does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to be a follower of Christ? It means to be a little Christ. If we want our kids to be a little Christ, and if we want to follow Christ, and the verb to follow means literally to walk the same road, then we better walk the same road as Christ. And we think about, what was that road? What was the road that Christ walked? And that was a road of, it was a road of loving people. It was a road of having mercy and compassion on people. It was a road of feeding those who were hungry, taking care of those who were sick. And we get to do all those things right here under the roof of our own houses with our own children. And so when I'm loving my kids and I'm serving them and I'm following Christ. And, but Christ is first, and we better be following after him hard ourselves as human beings. And if we're not doing that first, we don't have much to give to our kids.
So maybe what we need to do is stop reading so many Christian parenting books and start spending a bit more time in Scripture and just seeking God's face and understanding who God is.
That is absolutely right, Walt. That is absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, this has been good, and I really appreciate this conversation. I appreciate the book so much. We're going to include links to your website. I know you're going and you're speaking, even though you're in Alaska. You can travel anywhere, right? And
yep.
So people can check your schedule on your website. It's at LeslieLelandFields.com. We'll include a link to that. All of your books are listed there. We'll include links for ways to get a hold of those books, including Parenting is Your Highest Calling. And we appreciate the gift that you've been to us, and the gift that you've been to over the years, and the gift that you've been to people just in the short bit of time that we've had to talk today. Jason, is there anything else you want to add to this, or final closing thoughts?
Well, I just want to thank Leslie, this has been great. We really welcome your input here on the podcast, and honestly, it's been, just as a parent of small children, it's really refreshing to hear someone like yourself sharing the truth that you are. And so thank you for joining us, but more just thank you as a parent for your words.
Jason, go ahead, Leslie.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, thank you guys for having me. And I'm so happy to talk about this subject. It's so important. And, you know, that transformational moment in the, you know, in the woods, it really did completely change my life as a parent. It brought me so much more freedom and so much more grace. I feel like I can walk in the grace and freedom that Christ intended us to walk in, both as just as people and as parents. And I can also extend that to my children as well. So I'm if awesome. If some parent out there has gained something from this, I'm thrilled.
I'll end with this. Just a word to our youth worker friends there, and some of them who are listening are not parents. But I will tell you this, you can be a hero to parents by passing on to them great resources, things that you've learned about kids in their world, and certainly one of those little nuggets of truth that you can pass on, a treasure for them, is this article. We'll include a link to it as well, The Myth of the Perfect Parent, and we want to encourage you to pass that on to parents. So, Leslie, thank you for joining us. And for everyone who's listened in today, thanks for being a part of this episode of Youth Culture Matters. And we'll see you the next time around.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.